Thank you for your patience. Without any more from me, please welcome tonight's speaker, Doug R. from Tujunga, California.
Yeah, I knew this mic wasn't going to work. Did somebody want to do My name is Doug Rowell. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Grateful to be an alcoholic and grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I say that is just to piss off the newcomers. You know? Grateful, you moron. You know? I know I'm an alcoholic, but I don't have to be grateful for it. Thanks for the terminal illness, you know. But I'm absolutely sure my life's better today because I'm an alcoholic than it would have been if I hadn't been an alcoholic. And people like you that have made me grateful to be an alcoholic. I want to thank Pixie for inviting me, and I want to thank Jack for being in touch with me over the period, and certainly want to thank Mark for picking me up at the airport and took me to downtown Seattle. We had lunch at Pike's Place, and they ran out of coffee. And we sat at the bar. I told the bartender, you know, this is going on Facebook right now. I came to Seattle and they ran out of coffee. And I really want to thank Daryl, for starting this group. It's so impressive. I was here about 10 years ago and Daryl invited me and it was a lot smaller then. I know starting this meeting was an act of faith and service. And to see it grow like this and become self-supporting and drawing people to come in and want to be a part of it. And that's the best of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the best there is going on here. So thank you, Daryl. And I like doing this. I know some speakers who are like, who are very, very good speakers. They're so spiritual and so evolved that when you hear their story and their successes coming from the gutter and they're so you float right out of the room. I mean, you just lift right off your chair. You know, nobody would drink between here and Tacoma. You know, after they talk but some of them hate doing it. Pardon me, they hate to be asked. I'll do it. They do it out of courage or commitment or something like that. I don't know what they do, but I'm not like that. I don't know if I'm a good speaker or not, and I couldn't care less. I'm the guy tonight, and I love doing it. I wanted to be the speaker at the first meeting I ever went to. I was a little drunk that night. They didn't ask me, you know. But I sure would have given them a talk if they had asked, I'll tell you. I should tell you my sobriety date is June 7th, 1987. My home group is the Winner's Attitude Adjustment Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet every day at 7 a.m., every day of the year, corner of Colfax and Addison in Studio City, if you're ever there. And at 7 a.m. in the morning, please come in. It's just about 80 people in there, and we laugh a lot. And my sponsor's name is Bob Bazance. And some people say if you have those three things, a sobriety date and a home group and a sponsor, that's all you need to stay sober, which I take objection to that. I think like a big book is really helpful. but I guess if you have a home group and a sponsor, you'll get a big book. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking. I came pretty much to see what it was, and my life has benefited from it so much. The two things that I really objected to, I kind of liked AA when I first came to check it out. The two things that I really didn't like was, the not drinking thing. It just seemed a little over the top, you know. It's a little excessive. So you don't drink ever. Well, we don't do it one day at a time. Yeah, but I mean, okay, so like if I don't drink Monday and I don't drink Tuesday, then Wednesday I can have like, you know, a couple beers or something. Well, we don't know. It's not Wednesday yet. Yeah, that's what I thought. That's forever. Yeah, you're not fooling me with that one day at a time crap. So the not drinking was kind of excessive. And then there was a lot of God stuff, a lot of God talk here, which I didn't expect. And I'll tell you more about that later. I'm not the same person. I thought the fun would be all over if I stopped drinking. And the opposite is true. You know, I had a lot of fun drinking. You'll never hear me say I wouldn't trade my best day drinking for my worst day sober. In 28 years of sobriety, you're going to have a couple of lousy days, you know, and you don't have to drink over them. And when I was drinking, I had some incredible days, some beautiful days. And if you could trade one lousy sober day for one great drunk day, I might trade a week's worth or something, but that's just not the way they're dealt out. So I've been married faithfully and happily for 18 years to three of the finest women in AA. My wife Carla, some of you know Carla or have heard her, and my wife Carla will be here next year. No, not next year. Next month, March. She'll be here in March. And she gives a great talk. She doesn't mind me telling that my first wife, Randy 13-stepped me when I was 28 days sober. And we were together the first 15 years of my sobriety. After 15 years, it turned out we didn't have very much in common anymore, and we didn't go to even the same meetings, and we turned out to be more like brother and sister. We were living in the same house. We didn't hate each other. There was no fighting when we broke up, when we got divorced. There was no cheating or lying or stealing or guarding against each other. If you're both involved in a spiritual program, when the end of the relationship is over, you just go your separate ways, and we still love each other. But Randy taught me, but see, that's why they tell new people don't get involved romantically in your first year, because sure, it's great, you're happy and everything for 15 years, but then it just fizzles. But Randy taught me how to ask questions. Because I'm not naturally a question asker. To me, something in my makeup says, don't ask that question. If you ask the question, they'll think you don't know the answer. And I don't want people to think I don't know the answer. So I still have some of that. But when I was newly sober, I had a lot of it going on. And Randy and I were in bed one night, I have my leg over on her side of the bed, and she grabs my leg like a log and throws it over. She said, God, get on your own side of the bed. God, she said, you sleep like Jim Parks. Of course, I started, do I know a Jim Parks? I mean, I don't think I was trying to think, maybe somebody in the fellowship, Jim P, because, you know, she was sober 2.5 years when we got together. She had kind of active sobriety in her early times, you know. She was kind of promiscuous, but I had a promiscuous past. But I don't bring them into the marital bed, you know. I mean, I never say, you sleep like so-and-so, or you make love like so-and-so, or, oh, yeah, you have a nice ass, but you should have seen Shirley's or something like that, you know. It just seems rude to me. Rude, thoughtless, and inconsiderate to compare me. Oh, wait a minute. Randy was a voracious reader. She read everything. She read every book in the house. She read any book she happened to pass by, newspapers on a newspaper stand. If she ran out of stuff in the house to read, she'd read cereal boxes. She just loved to read. So, and she's read all the classics. And I'm like, you know, I'm not a big reader. And so if I say, who's Jim Parks? She may say something like, oh, I thought you were familiar with Lady Chatterley's Lover, you know. No, I'm an idiot. I'm a moron. I'm practically illiterate. No, I don't want to get, you know, oh, you've never read For Whom the Bell Tolls? Damn it. But I'm laying there working on this resentment, and I can feel this resentment coming in like the surf. And I know if I'm silently suffering, if I don't say anything, it's going to build up. And within a couple of days, I'm going to be walking around stomping, and she won't know what the problem is. She'll say something simple like, did you mean to leave your boots in the dining room? You know, and that's what it'll take, just a little trigger. And I'll just be like, boots, boots. Boots my ass, bitch. Hey, boot down on this. Who's Jim Parks? So I can squelch this right now. All I have to do is ask a question. Against my nature, but it's spiritual growth. And I said, I'm sorry, honey. Am I supposed to know who Jim Parks is and how he sleeps? And Randy was a cackler. She was like, you know, Jim across the street. Jim across the street that moved in here after you moved in. She said, yeah, you know how he puts his truck so you can't park behind him or in front of him without blocking a driveway? You sleep like Jim Parks. So anybody that's new in here, let me help you out. You can learn stuff asking questions. So I had, I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I don't come from an alcoholic family. My dad enjoyed a beer, really enjoyed. He liked to have a beer. Sometimes he would have two, usually not. Usually he'd be working on a Saturday. He'd be working on a car or working in the yard or something, watching a football game, come in and have a beer and then go back to what he was doing. He really enjoyed a beer, but the thought of drinking so much beer that it would affect your walk, talk, and driving just seemed insane to him. My mother may be an alcoholic. We don't know, because she won't drink, and you can't tell. How would you know? So when I got sober, and I'm looking for why I'm an alcoholic, and I asked my mother, Mom, are you an alcoholic? She said, what? I said, why don't you drink? Why do you care about that? Well, are you an alcoholic? She said, am I an alcoholic? Have you ever seen me take a drink in your life? I said, no, but I know hundreds of alcoholics that don't drink. What's your deal? She said, why do you care about this? And I said, well, because there's such a thing as a genetic predisposition. It may be your fault I'm a drunk. So. She goes, oh, and she had pretty much the same reaction you just had. And she said, I don't know. The fact is, when I was young, I drank, and every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, obnoxious, so I just stopped. It wasn't worth it. And I said, you got to drink through that, Mom. You know, there's, yeah, see, yeah, you guys know where I'm coming from. Like, the promised land lies beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious. But she doesn't know that. She doesn't have the tenacity to make this this program. You know, you got to stick with it. Give up on a little sick, stupid, and obnoxious. And besides that, I figure if I get sick, stupid, and obnoxious, it's really not even my problem. It's your problem. I don't know why I'm an alcoholic. I didn't start drinking too young. I never had a drink till I was 18. I had friends in school who drank, and I saw them get sick, stupid, and obnoxious, and it made it less attractive to me than it might otherwise have been. And you know, like I said, there wasn't much drinking in my house. But a friend of mine said, he was Morris, he was kind of my sexual sponsor. He said, Look, Doug, if you want to get a home run with this girl, you're good, because we use these baseball terms, you know, like we have this first base, second base, third base, home run. I don't even remember where the bases are now, but not for sure. I mean, it seems like there's not enough bases, you know. Besides that, I'm married. It's like step up to the plate and slide home. But at the I don't mean I get tagged for missing a base, but you know what I'm saying. It's not a challenge exactly anymore, you know. But in high school, it was a big deal, and I remember a home run, all right. And Morris said, if you want to get a home run with this girl, you're going to have to get her drunk. So I thought that was the rules. All of a sudden, now I'm a little bit interested in drinking. And so I went and stole a quart of Rainier Ale, which seemed like it was the national beverage of Garden Grove, California, where I grew up. This gal and I went and parked by the railroad tracks, and we'd been at the railroad tracks many times and sit there and neck and pat or whatever. And it was getting closer, but now I got my ammunition, you know. And I still didn't care about drinking. It really wasn't attractive to me. I would have been happy to say, here, drink this and let me know when you're ready. It just seemed kind of rude. So I opened, I drank some, and I handed it to her, and she drank some. And I think now, I think we were probably both there for the same reason, but we drank this quart of Rainier Ale, from your area, sort of. I got a buzz on, you know. That never happened to me before, and she did too. We both felt like warm and fun and attractive, so one thing led to another, turned out Morris was right. This was the first time I ever had an alcohol buzz, and the first time I ever had sex in front of a witness. I thought, well, I'm going to do both these things much as I can the rest of my life, you know. One thing led to another. I was a guitar player in high school, folk music, sang folk songs, the Kingston Trio and Peter, Paul, and Mary. And then as you get deeper into that, Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie and Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. So I started like playing some little venues with my guitar and singing, and got in a couple of bands. And I got in some rock and roll bands and played bass and guitar. And then I moved to Hollywood from Orange County and see if I could make a living playing music. And I moved into a home in Laurel Canyon with two other musicians. Somebody would say, hey, you want to play guitar or bass or harmonica on my record? So I do that, make a couple of bucks, got in a rock and roll band, I'm playing bass. somebody would say, would give me a job like singing background on a record or write a song, sell a song, co-write a song. So I was making enough money to pay the rent. I was a professional musician. And that was my life's goal. And what happened was a show came to town, a Broadway show called Hair, which was if you're young and you don't know, it was a musical comedy about hippies. And I love musical comedies. I love rock and roll and the blues. But I always like musical comedies, the Flower Drum Song and Oklahoma and The Music Man and all that stuff. People are walking down the street and just burst into song, and the whole city comes out and dances and sings with them. And I just love that. So this show Hair was about hippies on the street, but it was a musical comedy and it was rock and roll. So I went to see it at the Aquarius Theater. Oh my God, I fell in love. This is like all the things I love coming together. There was a character named Burger that came out and insulted the audience and stripped down to a loincloth and swung on a rope and screamed rock and roll and insulted the audience. I thought, I could do that. So I called the Aquarius Theater the next day. The receptionist answered, I don't think this can happen today. In fact, I'm sure it can't. I said to the receptionist, she said, Aquarius Theater, may I help you? Yes, I want to be in your show. She said, just a minute, I'll connect you. I think in that situation today, somebody would say, well, please have your agent contact us and da da da. But 1969 was a different world. And there was music and there was hippies and we owned a certain part of the entertainment world. So somebody off the street said, I want to be in your show. They connected with the company manager. He said, can I help you? I said, yeah, I want to be in your show. He said, well, can you sing and dance? And I said, yeah, that's what I do. That's how I make my living. Now, I never danced a step of my life. You know, I'm the guy up on the bandstand playing, watching you dance. Good dancing, bad dancing. How hard can it be? So, but I was comfortable with my singing. So, so the guys said, okay, well, what are you doing Friday at 1 o'clock? I said, you tell me. He said, we're having auditions Friday at 1 o'clock. What's your name? And I gave him my name, my phone number. He said, be here at 1 o'clock Friday. You got an audition. Now, this is like Wednesday afternoon. So he said, bring a piece of sheet music that you like to sing. Okay. So I went right down to the music store and I got a piece of sheet music, came back and practiced all night long. And then all day Thursday, I had my guitar out. I'm practicing this song, trying to work out the little subtleties of it and make it my own. And all day, I did nothing Thursday but practice this one song. Friday morning, I got my guitar out. I'm practicing the song, and I broke a string on the guitar, which it seems like a small thing now, but hippies were like, oh, bad karma, dude. So I went to my roommate's room to see if he had the string, and right in the middle of his dresser, along with all the other stuff on his dresser, was this envelope, D string. Good karma, dude. So, and underneath the envelope was a little white capsule. I thought, I wonder what that is. Oh, because we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything. And it's a good test. You know, it's a very effective test. Forget about automobiles and heavy machinery and all this stuff. That if you eat it, you're going to know exactly what it does. And if it's good, you'll remember it. And if somebody dies, don't eat the green shit, you know. So this turned out to be THC, synthetic marijuana. And did you hear this little oh that went through the audience? That's the only way I know to duplicate that is to go to a PTA meeting and say, did anyone lose a kitten? You know. But if you don't know, THC is a synthetic marijuana, and it's a nice little psychedelic. So about 45 minutes later, when I got to the Aquarius Theater, I went down on my Harley and with my sheet music in my hand, and I pull up to the Aquarius Theater, and it's put the kickstand down, and it seemed like it took about 3 minutes to get my leg over there. And at that time, my hair was long, was like over my shoulders, and just swished when I walked, you know. And I had these hip hugger bell bottoms on, big bells like that. They call them elephant bells, and no shirt on. I had a vest with 6 layers of foot long red, white, and blue leather fringe. Woo! Yeah, it was a walking wind chime, you know. And I floated up the stairs at the Aquarius Theater, and I just floated up the stairs, and I was at the back of the auditorium, and I'm seeing people down on the stage auditioning. I may have been a couple minutes late. And so I'm watching, I'm going, God damn, these hippies can sing and dance, you know. And I just almost forgot why I was there. And pretty somebody said, Doug Rowell, is Doug Rowell here? Yeah, and I went tearing down the aisle and up on stage, and I handed my sheet music to the piano player. And he opens it up, big smile, and he starts to play, bum, 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 bum. I said, what? I feel good. And I went into this James Brown number. I thought I was the godfather of soul. And I'm down on one knee and back up. And when I hold you, and I'm just bump, bump, bump. Wah! And they said, the people who were judging the auditioners, nudging each other. And this, and the main guy said, we love you, man. We love your energy. Can you do something a little mellower just so we kind of get a range of what you do? And I said, sure, sure. So I went into this a cappella version of Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay. Looks like nothing gonna change. And I made myself cry. You know, I was like, everything still remains the same. Piano player knew the tune. He picked it up. We were right in the pocket, you know. Could not fail. And got done, and they said, we love you, man. Just whew, great, great. Just what we're looking for. Just got to see a dance. By this time, I'm flying anyway. You know, I was like, hit it. And the guy started to play and I started to move. And I probably initially looked like the offspring of Joe Cocker and Julia Louis-Dreyfus, you know, just sort of a... But it got good to me. And I see my hair coming around. Getting trails off of this hair and the fringe on the vest, you know. And I'm sort of a tornado of trails here. And I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance? And I thought, I can dance. Who knew? So they hired me. But I thought I was auditioning for the Hollywood show. They were auditioning for the Las Vegas show. I didn't know that. So they said, great, we want you to do our show in Las Vegas. Can you report to Las Vegas Tuesday? I said, yeah, I can. Turns out they pay quite a bit of money, too. That's like union scale. And so I said, yeah, I can do that. So I had from Friday to Tuesday clean up my affairs and warned my roommates I wasn't coming home and jumped on my scooter. And ate a tab of Orange Sunshine, just headed out across the desert to report for fame and fortune. And so I got in that show, and I started understudying a couple of the lead roles, and we played Las Vegas for 6 months at the International Hotel. And then when that show ended, they sent us on the road. We became the first national tour of Hair. And we went to Indianapolis, then went to Pittsburgh and Cincinnati, and all around. We played 2 weeks here and 2 weeks there, up into Canada. 3.5 years, played all over the United States and Canada. And when we left Las Vegas, they gave me the lead role of Berger, the obnoxious speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. It was a stretch, but I could do it. And we would play someplace, and people would see. We started out in the audience, and then we would come on stage at the beginning of the show. And at the end of the show, we'd bring the audience up on stage. Come on up and dance with us. And people would come up, and big crowd of people. And somebody would come and say, hey, listen, man, we have a bar down the street. We want to close it off for the night and just have you guys and our friends there. So drinks are on the house all night long. Great. Drinks are on the house. That's the magic word. So we'd go and they'd party all night, you know, and somebody would come up and go, beautiful, man. You like pot? Here, Sinsamean, Maui Waui, Panama Red, Acapulco Gold. Give us all this great dope. You like acid? Here, Osley, Purple Haze, Orange Sunshine, Window Pane. got a witness. And so we would drink and use all over the United States and Canada. And it was like it was a requirement of the job almost, you know. And so by the time that show was over, I had become a father. We had with this gal that worked in wardrobe and we had a little girl, and we came back and I started auditioning for things and she was working as a temp and I'd work here and there, work in a parking lot, work in a theater, cleaning toilets, whatever, you know, trying to stay in the business, you know what? the guy working at the circus and somebody shoveling elephant crap and somebody says, what are you doing? He says, oh, I'm just an elephant crap shoveler. He goes, you like it? No, I hate it. Elephant crap, it stinks. It's dirty. Why don't you quit? What, and get out of showbiz? You know, so I mean, that's who I was. So I was trying to drink and use and audition for things and make a living and support my child. And my wife is working, or my daughter's mother. And finally, she had all of me she could take, and we split up. But I stayed in my daughter's life. And I got some work. I ended up working in television as a stagehand for I was parking cars at the Aquarius Theater. And a guy came in who had been the prop man on the show when we were on the road. And he said, what are you doing? I said, Bob, how you doing? Yeah, it's good to see you. He said, now, what are you doing? Well, I'm up for this Jack in the Box commercial. And I don't know, I got a call back on that. And I got a call back on Two Gentlemen of Verona, you know. So he goes, you're parking cars. Man, why don't you, go down to the Stagehand Union, tell them I sent you, and make some money while you're waiting for your ship to come in. So 25 years later, I'm waiting at the airport for my ship to come in. And, And I retired. Meanwhile, in that job, I started out with a pretty good reputation of being a good guy, and I drank more and used more, and until I finally lost it. By the way, when I say use, of course, I'm talking about illegal drugs. Let me make it clear, Alcoholics Anonymous is not a drug treatment program. Some people think it is, and it seems like maybe it should be, but it isn't. It's designed to help alcoholics overcome alcoholism, not to cure it, but to overcome with it, to learn to live with it, live happily and comfortably without a drink. But if you also happen to be a drug addict like I am, and so many alcoholics are, if you practice these 12 steps on your alcoholism, it does a wonder for your drug addiction. But drugs are an outside issue. They're the only one that everybody talks about. Parenting is an outside issue as well. This is not a parenting program, but nobody seems to mind if you talk about that. It's not a work program, but employment is an outside issue. But people talk about, I was a bad employee, I was a bad employer, I hated my boss, I had affairs with my boss, whatever, but nobody seems to mind that either. And driving, I don't even talk about driving. My God, the streets of Seattle are so much safer because we're in here than they were when we were out there. But just because I love Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to make it clear that I will talk about drugs. I already have. But if I had known, because you don't know when you're out there doing it, which way your sails are going to trim. So if I had just had an inkling, I promise you, the first time somebody said, "Hey, Matt, try this," I would have said, I would love to, but I'm going to be speaking at an AA meeting in 30 years, and I don't want to piss anybody off. Okay, so drugs are an outside issue, and I did plenty of them. I only used every drug I ever heard of, except for ones I've heard of since I got sober. And you wonder, did I miss the, that's why you hang out with new people. You see a new guy in your meeting, a new gal in your meeting, go up and talk to him, How you doing? Are you happy and comfortable? How long are you sober? Did you ever do any ecstasy? Because ecstasy is a good name for a drug, I'll tell you. But that's when, yeah, man, I did a lot of it. How was that? Dude, I'm here, So that wasn't the panacea either. I just used up my reputation. I started to get a bad reputation. One time, my daughter was about 12 years old. I went over. I stayed in her life. I used to pick her up from school, and she would stay with me the afternoon. And I'd take her to her mom's house when her mom got home from work. And her mom remarried and married a great guy named Stu that we got along just fine. And I stayed in my daughter's life, and I had good parents. I know what good parenting looks like, and I wanted very much to be a good parent. But sometimes my addiction would stand in the way. And I would tell you, my daughter was the most important thing in the world to me. But the facts is, the evidence is, that alcohol and drugs were more important than my daughter. If they weren't, I wouldn't let them stand in the way. One particular time, I went over to pick up my daughter on a Saturday afternoon. So pick her up at noon. We're going to go see a movie. Then we're going to go have dinner. She's going to stay at my house for the night, and I'll bring her back Sunday afternoon to her mom. Simple as that. And I'm looking forward to it. And by the time I got from my house, 15 miles away from her house, I was already drunk. And I knew I was, and I did it again. And I try to act like I was just in a funny mood, maybe they won't notice. And I wasn't there 3 minutes before her stepfather walks me out on the front porch, and he said, "Doug, you're drunk." I said, yeah, I am. Because if you're new, let me tell you, if somebody says to you, "Have you been drinking?" they already know the answer. So there's no point in trying to hide that. So I said, "Yeah, I am." And he said, "Well, damn it, I can't let Star get in the car with you." And I got that. He's right. He's right. He's doing what he should do. And it broke my heart. And he said, these words are burned in my memory like a branding iron. He said, Doug, understand, you're welcome in our home anytime, sober. Don't come over here drunk anymore. It's very hard on Star. It's exactly what he said. And I heard every syllable of it, and I understood all the context of it. There was nothing I could do about it. I couldn't get undrunk. He didn't say, don't come over here drunk. We're afraid you're going to embarrass us in front of the neighbors or break the furniture or fall in the pool. He said, don't come over here drunk. It's very hard on Star. He's protecting my only child, the most important person in the world to me, from me. And that's what he should do. I understood every bit of that. And I just said, I'm sorry, I was really looking forward to this. And he said, so was I, and so was Star. And hope you come back sober. And I said, this will never happen again, and I meant it. And I left there, and I got in my car, and I started to drive home, thinking what a scumbag I am. And I started to cry, and once the tears started, it was like Niagara Falls. I couldn't stop them. I couldn't see to drive. I'm like this. I turned on the windshield wipers. Seemed like a good idea at the time. And I finally pulled into a parking lot, little strip mall parking lot, and then I opened the door and put my feet on the pavement and put my head in my hands, and I just sobbed like a baby. I couldn't stop it. And I looked up, and I saw this red neon sign that said liquor. And I got out of the car, closed the door, I went into the liquor store, and I bought a pint of whiskey. And I came back to the car, and I opened up that bottle, and I had a little drink, then I had another one, and I was okay. I was all right. This is something that non-alcoholics can't understand. They don't understand. The most aware and evolved Al-Anon in the world understands that there is that feeling, but it's not the same as feeling. It's not the same as knowing it. It's not the same as Bill D., Alcoholics Anonymous number 3, when he was in his bed, Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson came to talk to him, and Bill D. said, listen, I know you guys mean well, but don't waste your time. People have come and talked to me about my drinking before. It never does any good. And they said, we didn't come to tell you about your drinking. We came to tell you about our drinking. And they did. And he said, you guys are like me. And they left. And when they came back the next day, Bill D's wife was there. And Bill said, these are the guys I told you about, the ones who understand. That's who, you're the ones who understand. If you're new, we're the ones who understand. We didn't come here to talk to you about your drinking. You know. We just came to offer you our hand in case you need it, in case you can use it. And then you can offer a hand to somebody else. And that's what we do here. But you understand when I say I had a couple of drinks and I was okay. When I was in this palpable pain, this unrelievable pain and disgust with myself, and I had a couple of swallows of a liquid, and it makes me feel okay. How would you ever give that up? How could you give that up? You know, because you guys understand. There are heads nodding here. Every time I tell this story in an AA deal, there are heads nodding. You understand. If you tell this story at a PTA meeting, they they look at you like you're an unfit parent or something, you know. And I had experiences like that with my daughter, with my mother, with women that I loved. I had a lot of mistakes that mostly I injured myself. I mean, I hurt other people too, more than I ever thought I did, but I injured myself a lot. I was, for instance, I was skiing at Mammoth. And the way I like to ski is I get on the lifts at about 8:30 when they first open and the snow is all fresh and groomed, and take off my gloves and hook them on my vest reach in here and get my little vial of cocaine and do a little one-on-one to wake up. And then I reach over here and get my flask and my whiskey and have a couple of pulls on that. Yeah, yeah, loosen up some, put that away, reach over here and get my pipe, my windless pipe, so I can enjoy the scenery on the way up to the top of the hill. And put everything away, and make sure my bindings are good, have my little boater bag, a shot of white wine. Get all loose, you know, because then you're sort of a soul skier, you know what I'm saying? You know, the feeling matters much more than the seeing, and it's great. It really does loosen you up. I thought I could ski better. The problem is, if you keep doing it after 20 or 30 runs, you're really in no condition to be involved in an athletic event. So this one time I was up there, and it was in the afternoon when the shadows are getting long and the snow is starting to ice over, and I went down this run. I'd been down several times. There's a hard left at the cliff. I didn't miss the turn. I went off the cliff, but it was a decision. I thought I could do it. It was right after the Winter Olympics, and I see these guys jump 170 meters or whatever, you know, and they sail through the air. They lean way over the front of their skis. No matter what else their style is, they all lean over the front of their skis. And I thought they did it for looks, but it turns out if you don't do that, your skis go straight up in the air. So I don't know the physics behind that, but now you're heading towards the planet head on the bottom, skis on the top, and it's not like some Wile E. Coyote thing where they're going to turn into a helicopter. No, you're going to land head first on the earth. Fortunately, my shoulder hit a rock before my head hit and broke my shoulder, and the ski patrol had to take me down the hill, and my sister was there, and she drove me back home to L.A., and I got in the hospital, and they operated on my shoulder, and I'm out of work for 6 weeks while the shoulder's healing, and I got back to work, and I was back to work for about, I don't know, 6 weeks, I guess, 6 or 8 weeks, and then somebody had a party that lasted all night long. Friday night party was just party, 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 and people started leaving, and in the morning there was just four of us left, and the woman who owned the house said, somebody take me to the store, I'll get some eggs and make breakfast. I said, I'll do it. So we got on my bike and started. I don't know why I thought Harleys and eggs was a good combination, but we're going to the store and it's April. And April in Southern California, it's not hot and it's not cold. It's brisk, you know, and so a motorcycle ride in the morning and the sun is just coming up. You know how it lights up just a little line across this horizon and then it starts to rise and light everything up. That's what time it was. And it was before the helmet law in California. So our hair is flying in the air and everything and the rumble of the Harley, everything was so sexy. We both had this like telepathy feeling. We should make love in the great outdoors. And I don't know if you're familiar with downtown Burbank, but it's, not a place with a lot of great outdoor lovemaking venues. But we found a four-story parking structure. Oh, great. But the gate was locked. So I said, well, let's go to the fire escape. Went to the fire escape, parked the bike, went up the fire escape. But the door is locked on the fire escape. So I said, well, you know what? Fire escape door is unlocked from the inside. It has to be. It's a law. So I jumped up on the wall and I'm going to drop over and open the door. That's the whole plan. But sometimes my plans don't materialize exactly like I plan them, and I'm hanging by this wall, this four-story parking structure, swinging back and forth, figuring out somehow I'm going to get over this wall, open the door, but I never did. I remember seeing the building going up and thought, well, this is a stationary building. I must be falling, and so 54 feet. My dad was an engineer. He was a mathematician. He figured out while I was recuperating that 185-pound man falling 54 feet takes 1.3 seconds. Not very long, but it's long enough, you know, to know this is not good. I landed feet first, but of course the speed buckled my knees and I kicked myself in the ass, what happened, and I broke my pelvis in two places. And snapped the heel bone off my right foot and shoved it through my foot. like a bowling ball and just broke all those little bones in your foot and turned my foot look like a ball, like a tether ball with toes, except that it was more colors than you've ever seen on a piece of skin. It was black and blue and green and yellow and orange, but here's the deal. God has always been with me, whether I recognize it at the time or not. This was the parking structure of St. Joseph's Hospital. So the woman who was with me ran into the hospital, into the ER, and said, "Help me, my friend just fell off your parking lot and it broke him." And he's easy to find. He's right at the bottom of the fire escape that had crumpled up there. He's not walking anywhere. And so they picked me up. Then she called her husband to come and get my bike, which I would have called somebody else to get the bike. But anyway, I was in the hospital for 10 days while they tried to figure out how to put my foot back together, and they finally came up with a deal. I was in surgery for 8 hours while they x-rayed and pinned and manipulated and pinned and x-rayed and finally put it back together. I couldn't walk for 5 months except with a crutch or a cane or something. And they took a blood alcohol level, which was 0.40. And my friend Teddy got sober right about then. And she was an example. I saw her. She was fun to drink with, but she was dangerous. And you never knew if she was going to start a fight with somebody and you were going to be in it. So I'll drive. No, you won't. But Teddy got sober and turned into a lady real quick, surprisingly quick. Show up. She'd be where she said she was going to be when she said she was going to be there, dressed appropriately and speaking in whole sentences. But every time I talked to Teddy, she'd drop words in like big book and sponsor and steps and meetings. And finally I said, "Look, I don't know if you're trying to recruit me or not, but let me tell you something. If I ever see alcohol interfering with my life, I probably will go to AA." And she just stood there with her mouth open. She said, "Damn, Doug, what would you call interference? Brain death?" I said, "Okay, I see where you're going with this. But I don't think accidents should count. You know, anybody fall off a four-story building is going to get hurt. So drunk or sober. In fact, it might have helped me that I was drunk. I don't know. But I think you got alcoholism mixed up with gravity, honey, you know." So she just said, "Okay, whatever." And she got out of there. But all that week, every time I had a little quiet moment, you know, where thoughts come into your head, I'd picture Teddy's face saying, "What would you call interference? Brain death?" And every time I thought of that, I'd think, that's a possibility. The accidents I told you about, some that I didn't tell you about, and the next one might end up in brain death. Easily could. It's not an impossibility. In fact, it's a likelihood if I keep doing it. If I keep drinking, I could end up in a situation where I'm in a wheelchair or in bed for the rest of my life, unable to feed myself or go to the bathroom by myself, and know it. That's a scary thought. It scared me so bad, I rushed right down to AA 3 years later. And I went to my first meeting to see what AA was. You know, I went early, and I went early because I didn't know what time it started. It turned out it was an 8:30 meeting. I got there at 6:30, so I got there early enough to see people sitting up chairs, and it was a big meeting. It's a big 200-people speaker meeting, and in a subterranean community room at Valley Presbyterian Hospital in Van Nuys. And so I got there. Somebody said, "Go to a big speaker meeting. They'll leave you alone." It's not true. If you're new, you're at a big speaker meeting, we don't leave you alone. We don't stay sober leaving new people alone. So, but I guess they meant, you know, you wouldn't be asked to share or something. But anyway, people are coming up to me, "You're new." And I go, "Nope, I'm not." And most of them would walk away except this one guy, Hank. He comes up and he goes, "You're new." I said, "No, I'm not." And I didn't scare him away. He said, "Oh, I haven't seen you here before. What's your name?" I said, "My name's Doug, and you haven't seen me here because I haven't been here before. It's the first time I've ever been here." Oh, well, that's what we mean by new, man. It's like new. You're welcome to AA, man. I said, All right. I'm new like a new, never been here before guy, but I'm not new like a new member. Okay. I don't know what it looks like from the outside, but I promise you I'm not over here, help me, help me, I'm drowning in a sea of alcohol. That's not my deal, man. That's not me. I just came to check it out. I'm observing, okay? I'm just seeing what's going on here, man. I'm just auditing the class, okay? You got that? The thing is, I'm not a joiner, man. I just never have been. I'm an outlaw. You know, I'm a desperado. You know what I'm saying? A loner, a misfit. I never fit any place in my life. I don't fit in school. I don't fit in the workplace. I barely fit in my own damn family. I'm certainly not going to fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous, for Christ's sake. You know, hug, hug, laugh, laugh. Isn't it good we're not drinking? Now, I'm watching. It's not that attractive to me, to tell you the truth, you know. But I'm checking it out, okay? You know, so don't give me your number. Don't ask for mine. That's not going to happen. Don't put me on your little roster, okay? I'm just not a joiner, man. I'm over here minding my own business. You might try that sometime, see how that works for you. And this guy, you can't scare you people away. You can't insult you away, you know? This guy goes, yeah, I like you. You're going to fit right in. And I understand what he means now, but at the time I'm like, well, do you speak English? You know what? I thought I was pretty articulate about how I was not going to fit in. But there was another. So people were saying, there's some chairs over here, some empty chairs if you want to sit down. So now, I've been here a long time since they were setting up the chairs. I'm watching people come in. They put down a jacket, put down keys, put down a purse. No purse, no keys, no jacket. That seat's available. I get it. I'm a figure outer. But I don't want to sit down because I may have to leave before the thing's over, you know. And so, I'll stay back here. I'm okay standing up because I didn't know if I was going to have to leave. And it's funny. When I think about it today, if somebody today said I may have to leave before it's over, I would expect they were going to get a call or a text or something, you know, oop, got to go. Nobody had cell phones in 1986. Some people had pagers. I didn't even have a pager. I had nobody wanted to contact me. What the hell did I need a pager for? You know, I'd leave me alone pager. I might have one of those, you know. What I had was a garage door opener with a belt clip on it. And so I look important, you know, and it would never bother you. And plus, it's real handy if your drink alarm goes off. You know, your head sometimes says, what are you doing? Don't talk to this guy. Go get a drink. I could go, I got to get this. Yeah. And it was great. It was real handy. And it was handy unless somebody said, what is that? It looks like my garage door opener. And, oh, yeah, it is. It's a combination garage door opener, pager, and TV remote. You know, it's the latest, coolest thing. I got one. And so there was another guy standing up through the meeting, too, on the other side of the double doors. And he looked kind of like me. And I had a long hair and a beard. And we were standing up the back when the meeting started and everybody else was sitting down. And I thought, we're the cool section here. We're cool, too cool to sit, you know. We're like, so we were so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. So they started the meeting, and people read stuff. And at one point, they said, we have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. I thought, oh, that's cool. They celebrate people's birthdays. So I didn't know. You know, I'm looking around for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny honey. And Ruth gets up. It's a meeting like this with a stage. And Ruth is the only one walking toward the stage, and she's 50 if she's a day. And at first I thought, God damn, if she's 18, she should stop drinking today. But she didn't look bad. She looked good. You know, she was... She was dressed up and made up and coiffed, you know, so I thought, okay, this is Ruth. This is AA. They don't drink here. Ruth hasn't had a drink in 18 years. I get it. I told you I'm a figure outer. So I thought, well, happy birthday, Ruth. Oh my God, I cued the choir. I didn't know, you know, I don't know. They do this a lot of places. Some places they don't. In Southern California, they call anniversaries of sobriety a birthday, and they sing happy birthday, and they have a cake with candles, and they blow it out. So that's what happened. There's a couple of young girls came out holding this cake, and Ruth got up, and everybody sang, happy birthday to you, 200 people singing happy birthday in four different keys at the same time. And it didn't seem to bother anybody but me. And surely I'm not the only musician in the room. Damn. And many of them were not even committed to the key they started in. And there was a piano on stage with a sheet over it. And I thought somebody in this room, just like somebody in this room, I'm sure, positive, no doubt about it, can fake happy birthday on the piano. Any group of 200 Americans, somebody can fake happy birthday. It's CGD. It's not hard. I thought, well, I could do it. I'm not even a piano player, and I could do it if I wanted to. Maybe I should run up there. Hold it, folks. Yank that sheet off the piano. Here I come to save the day, you know, and get everybody in the same key. And I thought, you know, sometimes that hero thing doesn't work out like you think it's going to. Why don't you just shut up? It's a short song. So, okay, I shut up. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back. And I'm like, okay. Ruth gets up. She says, my name's Ruth, and I'm an alcoholic. And everybody, of course, goes, hi, Ruth! And I thought, oh, jeez. This is like kindergarten. My friend Scott R. used to say, this is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. I didn't know you could go to a meeting every day, let alone every day for 18 years. I'm really trying to sink this in. I look over at the other cool guy to see if he's laughing. He's heading towards me, and now I know I'm alone. He's a member. I know this because he's got his hand out like we do, you know, and it's that sunbeam for Jesus smile. Takes my hand in both hands, and he says, tell you what, stay sober a year, and we'll give you one of them cakes. Oh, hey, there's something to look forward to. Don't drink for a year. A year. Thanksgiving to Thanksgiving. And we'll give you a cake. So I was so shocked, I couldn't even insult him, you know. I just, because it seemed like to me, if you don't drink for a year, you ought to get a car, you know, something. And I said to him, I'm not much of a pastry eater, but thanks. Thanks for the offer. And I realized I don't know anything about this guy. I know the way he looks, but I don't know anything about him, except now I know he values cake more than I do. But at some point, the secretary held up this book, and she said, this is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, the basic text of our program, the only authority on AA. If you're new here tonight, please don't leave without this book. We sell it at our cost. And I thought, I'm new. We established that. You don't have to worry about your cost because I'm stealing the book. I'm going to steal the book. They had a bunch of them on a table with some other literature, and I knew I could go and pick this up, act like I'm fascinated with it, walk right out the door. And if they even noticed, they'd say, leave him alone. I just had a feeling, and I could hardly wait to try it. But then she screwed it up. Before the meeting was over, she said, if you're new tonight and you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have the book. We'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week till you get back on your feet. Great. Now, if I steal the book, you're going to think I'm homeless. So I have my pride. I will steal from you, but I won't accept your goddamn charity. So now I got to wait till the end of the meeting for sure. And I got to go up to her. It's a hardcover book. It's probably 20, 25 bucks. I don't care how much it is. 30 bucks, 40. I don't care. If I got to write a bad check, I'm buying that book tonight. So I go up to her after the meeting. And I said, excuse me, ma'am, can I buy one of your books? She said, the big book. Yeah. Yeah, the big book. Yeah, I've seen bigger. How much is that big book? She said, it's $4.65. Do you have it? $4.65? Yeah, I think I can handle that. Here's a five. Keep the change. She said, no, I'll get your change. No, please, ma'am. Listen, I'm I'm on my feet, okay? So use that change to help a drunk or something, all right? So I got my book, and on the way home, I stopped at a liquor store and got a fifth of whiskey, and I get home with my bottle and my book, sat down and poured three fingers of whiskey, and I started to read this book. And I promise you, I did not stay up all night studying the book. I have the ability to look at the title of a chapter, almost any book, and pretty much know everything in the chapter. I don't know. It's a gift that I have. And so doctor's opinion, I didn't even bother with that. I've had doctor's opinion. So I got into the basic text of the book. Chapter 1, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter 2. There's a solution. That's a sales pitch. Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. That's a sales pitch. Actually, that sounded like it might be the most boring piece of literature in the English language. I trade that, save it till I'm, you know, feel like I got toothpicks in my eyes from tweaking, you know, like, oh. But now I got to chapter 4, We Agnostics. And I didn't expect a chapter called We Agnostics. I got fooled. I expected to walk into AA and find a bunch of atheists and agnostics who used to drink like me and don't drink like that and don't drink anymore. That's what I expected to find. And, you know, this thing is so full of God that I was just so disappointed and irritated. And I almost thought, I don't know if I can come back here. But now I'm reading this book, and they got a chapter called We Agnostic. Here it is. Here's how the smart people stay sober without God. So I poured another three fingers of whiskey, and I read the whole chapter. And I thought, I have absolutely no idea what I just read. So poured some more whiskey and read it again. Then I poured some more whiskey and read it again until finally, because it's not saying what I want it to say, you know, it's what it's supposed to say. Finally, a sentence jumped off the page that said, We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him. And I thought, I never heard that before. I never heard any, it's a pretty subtle little sentence, but it's very significant. I thought, it seemed to me that I knew something about a lot of religions, most of the religions in the world. Wasn't any kind of an expert, but I had a little knowledge, a thought. My grandmother was a Pentecostal minister. She found Jesus and stopped drinking and lived the rest of her life in service like we do, to the church. But she hated AA. And so I thought there was no God here. And my grandmother's Pentecostal church never said, we don't think God makes hard terms of anything. They said just the opposite. You know, they call me, you know, we are very sure that God makes hard terms on those who seek him. Boy, you know God will not even hear your prayers unless you're baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist. I'm talking about total submission, son. That's why we got a tank of water for Christ up here. Come on up, boy. Come on up. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus. Amen. Somebody get the boy a towel. I'm like 14 years old. I am not getting wet in this room tonight. I know my grandmother wouldn't let these guys drown me, but she might not be able to stop. Maybe she told them I touched myself, you know. Maybe they could be sending my ass to Jesus for my own good. So I'm out of there. But it wasn't just the Pentecostals who were over the top. My girlfriend was Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, and much other cons to determine how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers would cleanse her soul of the various kinds of sins. Because, you know, Catholics don't have sin. They have categorized venial, menial, cardinal, mortal. Some of them, you don't even have to do them. If you think about them, express way to hell. Like, really, burning perdition for thinking about sin for a second. Oh, this is not for me. My friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew, and he and his brother Sherm had to wear spit curls to school, which, oh, there's a loving God for you. And went over to their house for dinner one night. You know, Mrs. Stein says, Doug, would you like to join us in some wine and challah? I said, some what? Would you like to join the family in some wine and challah? I said, well, I'll have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater, Mrs. Stein. And there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. But what happened was, this let me off the hook a little bit, and I went back to AA, and I started falling in love with AA. And the more meetings I went to, the more I started falling in love with him, realized that I'm just like everybody here. I thought maybe someday I'll stop drinking. Because my first 8 months in AA, I didn't have a home group. I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment anywhere. I didn't believe in God, and I was drinking every day. Except for that, I had a pretty good program. But at some point, I came home from a meeting, and I had four different sobriety dates at four different groups. I was dishonest. I came home from a meeting about 10:30 at night, turned on the TV and laid on the floor and drank whiskey till I passed out. And that's what I usually did. And I woke up about 3 a.m., which I usually did. And I turned off the TV and my bottle was half full. And I crawled on my hands and knees through the living room, through the hallway, into the bedroom to go to bed, which some people call pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. You know, I just called it going to bed. I thought it was brilliant. Hey, you can't fall off the floor. So I got in the bedroom and I stood up to get undressed and I fell. As soon as I stood up, I fell on my knees and I spilled this whiskey all over the bed. And I grabbed the bottle and there's still a little bit left in the bottle, but most of it was in the bedspread. So I set the bottle in a safe place and I grabbed this bedspread and started sucking whiskey out of it. Some voice in my head said, "Hey, man, that ain't right. You thirsty? There's whiskey in the bottle." Man. I'm like, not thirsty. I'm frugal. I'm frugal. I'll waste my life, but I'm not letting whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight. But what happened was I looked at what I'm doing. There is this whiskey in the bottle, and I'm done drinking. And I've been going to AA for 8 months, and I haven't learned how to not suck whiskey out of a bedspread. And I did a dumb thing. I said, "God, if you're there, please help me." And I didn't think anybody heard it. I just was out of ideas. I went to bed and I went to sleep. And over the next couple of weeks, every single day, some odd thing would happen. Not miraculous, not the parting of the Red Sea, but every day I go in my neighborhood liquor store. There's somebody from AA behind the counter. That's never happened before. So I didn't get a drink there, but I got a drink someplace else. But I was in the supermarket in the liquor department. Reach out for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time. Keep it simple. And I'm in a restaurant in Burbank. I start to order a margarita. The waitress is somebody I know from AA. This is happening every day. Just boom, boom, boom. Somebody from AA between me and a drink. And it didn't stop me from drinking. It just created hurdles. I had to jump over to get a drink. But at the end of this 2 week period, 14th day, I'm on the way to work at 6:30 in the morning, and I just killed a half pint of Bushmills, and I don't keep empty bottles in the car. They're illegal and useless. And so I roll down the window and toss this bottle just as the guy from AA was driving towards me at 6:30 a.m. And he saw me and waved, and I let that bottle go in front of his car. Bang-da-lang, ding-ding. I thought, where are these people coming from? This can't happen. I mean, it's just like every time I reach for it, there's somebody from AA with it. Yeah, and it's like those damn miracles they talk about in the meetings. It's exactly like that. And I pulled the car over to the side of the road, and I sat there. I remember that I'd been on my knees and said, "God, if you're there, please help me." And just like a slideshow, all these days went by, these people between me and a drink, and I realized that I had asked for help, and I had gotten the help, which is exactly what people at AA told me to do. Ask God for help and the help will come. But I thought it was like a metaphor or a parable or something. That's what happened. I asked God for help and the help came. And I recognized it in a funny way, a little pain in the ass God jokes. But it got my attention finally. And I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And I started to hear the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I stopped drinking and using. And I've been sober since then. And when I say here in the music of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're not new, you probably know exactly what I mean. There's a rhythm and a harmony and a melody that runs through this thing that makes the words make sense. And I think the music is laughter, really. We come in here sick unto death and dying and feeling like we'll never laugh again. And what's so damn funny anyway? What are you people laughing at? My God, I'm dying over here. And you stick around and you hear somebody laughing and you realize it's you. How many times have I heard somebody say, "I heard somebody laughing and I realized it was me"? And that's what happened. We start to laugh and loosen up And we end up laughing ourselves weller than we were before we got sick. My friend Clancy says there's about 300 different 12-step meeting groups, and nobody laughs like alcoholics. And of the 12-step groups that I've been to, that seems to hold true. We laugh a lot. We laugh ourselves weller than we were before we got sick. And if you're new here, I beg you to stick around and give it a shot. You know, do something that you wouldn't ordinarily do. Because there are people in this room tonight who will be handed this incredible gift and say, no thanks, I'd rather get loaded. That's just the way it is. But if you're new, you don't have to be that one. You can be the one that does the things that you know are not going to help, but somebody that you know doesn't know anything. And your life will get better. And people around you will see the growth in you before you do. And if you stay sober a year, we'll give you a cake. Thanks for letting me share with you.